Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
He says, I met Aaron Brady in a pub one night. It was after a wedding, and he told me that he shot the guard. I says, Grant, I said, you put that down in a statement? And he says, no, he wouldn't. Just telling you, I'm trying to help you out, like, he said. And I said, that's fine, I said, but I do need to have it on writing. I spoke with him for a period of 3 months. It's no good having this knowledge and not departing it in a way that's going to benefit the investigation and bring Aaron Brady to justice.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
In January 2013, Detective Garda Adrian Donoghue was murdered as he carried out a routine cash escort duty at the Lordship Credit Union in Dundalk in County Louth. Now, 10 years on, journalist Robin Schiller and an officer who was one of the vast investigation team on the case, former Detective Inspector Pat Murray, have joined forces to tell the story of the hunt for Adrian's killers. Today, I'm talking to Robin and Pat about their new book, Murder at Lordship, Inside the Hunt for a Detective's Killer, which is available now. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Pat, it was January 2013 when this occurred in Lordship. I remember being up myself in the aftermath. Two things struck me outside that credit union, and the first was how quickly you could get to the north from it, obviously on the roads. But the second thing was that the school that the children went to was across the road, and the national school, they had to look across at where their father was killed for.
Yes. Yeah, and how Caroline stomached that for so long, I don't know, but it would have been a hard pill to swallow. I guess the children were settled at school and they had to probably row in and just do what they could for a bit of normality. But there's no normality from the 25th of January 2013 at 9:25 p.m. Things changed. They certainly changed in the atmosphere in with all his colleagues, obviously his family, and I think the Garda organisation as a whole, and the people of Dundalk.
Mm.
And I'd go even further again, the people of Ireland were shocked and disgusted at what happened. And especially if you knew Adrian Donoghue, he was a really nice guy.
Mm.
You know what I mean? A lovely fella to deal with, you know, no hassle, very good at his job, and very good community man.
Mm.
Outside of his work with the guards, he took teams for training and helped all the young people. And so it was a devastating blow to everything that was good.
It was something that nearly put Lordship on the map for all the wrong reasons. So just, I suppose, remind us exactly what happened that night.
Well, that night, Adrian, and it's funny how it goes, like Adrian and Joe were doing this cash escort on overtime because we wouldn't have had enough manpower working at the time. And it was always known that it would be done in overtime. So Adrian was asked, would he do it? And he says, yeah, I'll come in and do it. And he came in with Joe, and Adrian got the keys of the car and threw them to Joe. You drive tonight. could have easily have been Joe picking the keys up and throwing them to Aidan. Mm. And Joe says, fair enough. And he headed off and they were going to go out to Omid first to the cash from the credit unions were being gathered up by the volunteers for these credit unions. And it culminates them eventually going to Lordship Credit Union, which is the last credit union on the route. They were to obviously escort the car with the money down to the bank where it would be lodged. But that night, Adrian and Joe were in the car. Adrian obviously was in the passenger seat. They drove into the car park and they, as a result of a previous robbery there, they wouldn't come out with the money from the post, from the credit union, unless the guards were there. And they could see, the guy inside could see that the guards were there and the cars were circling. And
And how much money would they have had, would you be talking about?
Well, the first robbery, they got away with 27 grand around that. This time they had missed, I don't know, something like the guts of 40 grand or something like that.
It was a good bit of money though. It was over 20,000 they were targeting. Oh,
Yeah. Because they had got in excess of 20 before. Mm. And we knew who had committed the crime the first time around. And that's what the modus operandi was, exactly the same. So it was reasonable to think that it's maybe the same crew. So that's why our thinking, and my thinking as senior investigating officer, that it may be the same crew or it may be some.
Before we just come on to that, exactly what happened? They had pulled up in the car park
this Passat car pulled up in the entrance to the car park, not allowing the staff in their own cars to come out or the Garda car to come out. And Adrian got out to see what was happening. Obviously, he'd be conscious that this is not right. And when he looked, when he got out of the car, there was two people coming towards the car, one armed with a shotgun and the other armed with a handgun. Mm. And the guy with the shotgun, which was a single barrel long barrel shotgun, it wasn't cut down or anything, discharged the shot the width of the car. You may be talking 5-7 feet, hitting Adrian right in his right eye. Mm. And I was at the post-mortem and like the wadding and all was in his eye. Like, you know, he was just point blank shot. Like,
it was quite a chaotic thing to do during one of those robberies. Like, they were very organised, this gang. When you look back to maybe some of the other robberies, they were in and out quickly, got the money and gone.
Yeah, but if you look at the pattern of robberies up on the border at the time, there was a place called Morgan Fuels a couple of weeks beforehand where it was robbed and they shot a guy in the leg for no reason, shotgun. So, you know, these people...
But I suppose, Robin, the killing of a police officer is rare, thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully. Oh, yes. Like even that robbery itself, you know, from the time that Passat pulled up to the exit of Lordship and hemmed in that convoy to when it drove off, it was 58 seconds, like, you know, to a T. The CCTV would have played in the trial, the murder trial, 2020, and you can see, like, just the car pulls up. The first two raiders over the wall, they're hiding behind the back wall of Lordship. They're the two men with the guns, one with a shotgun and one with a handgun, and they run directly towards the Garda car. And there's about three other cars in the car park, and they ignore all them, and they go with purpose to the car that's carrying the armed Garda. So it shows even the pre-planning involved, that they knew exactly what they're looking at, who to target. And then unfortunately, as Pat was saying there, Adrian Dunne, who stepped out, he wasn't even looking at who was coming to his right. He's more focused on the Passat blocking the entrance, and he didn't even have a chance.
But what was the purpose of targeting, you know, the officers?
Prior to that robbery and some months beforehand, there was a commissioner's directive to take the Uzi machine gun away from detectives, which was a disaster because the detectives, especially on the border, commanded great respect from the criminal fraternity and the subversive people, that the guards had protection and would use them. And when that was taken away from the detectives, it was in the newspapers and it was all around the place. So you had this criminal element that now knew the guards wouldn't have an Uzi machine gun. And I remember writing a detailed report from everything, the health and safety issues down to what the functions of the guards are for the protection of the state and why the gun was necessary for the detectives on the border. And I asked that the gun, that there is a machine gun, be given to the detectives patrolling the border. And a week before Adrian's murder, it came back with no. If we had to use a machine gun, the criminals wouldn't take on the guards. It wouldn't have happened. So that's how...
But, I mean, in saying that, you're saying that within those few seconds, all that went through the minds of these raiders. It seemed to be a chaotic thing to have done.
No, they would have known that night. There was no Uzi machine gun. The guards didn't have an Uzi machine gun. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
I think even from a, I suppose, logistical point of view, carrying out the robbery, you're obviously going to, the biggest threat to them is the armed guards. It's not the credit union workers in their 60s or 70s now carrying the cash. It's the armed guardie. And obviously from their point of view, the plan is to, I suppose, prevent them from stopping them firing back their arm. But you don't even know what goes through somebody's head.
It's such a huge risk for 40,000, isn't it, though? You know,
I mean... Things like that. And if you look at, during the course of that trial, Aaron Brady was needing money and had told his girlfriend that she was looking for a car and he was promising it. And he was sort of telling her, I'm doing a bit of work and I'll have money, So he was under pressure for money. And when Adrian stepped out of the car, he would have known Adrian. And Adrian was such a good policeman, he would have arrested all of them. He would have known them personally. And even with balaclavas on them, I'm sure he thought, Adrian Dunne will know me.
They did have an opportunity, though, to get away, no?
They came down with the pure function of stealing money, getting it and getting away with the money. And that's exactly what they did. Even poor Joe Ryan, he saw the flash in that, but he didn't think Adrian was hit or anything at that stage. When they were all gone, he got out of the car, he saw him. So the other raiders may not have realised that Adrian Dunne was shot at that stage. When they went to the other cars, one of them smashed a window with a hammer. Another one went to another car and demanded money off one of the ladies. So those may not have known.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess when you look at it, the intent of bringing a loaded firearm to Robbie,
that is intent, yeah.
Yeah, and that's it. And regardless if... and they would have known that.
So what happened in the immediate aftermath of it then? There was obviously... I mean, there was national outrage that this had happened. And do you know how the investigation got going?
I was sitting at home with my wife and it was sort of raining outside and stuff. And the phone rang at about 9:30 and was my superintendent, Jerry Curley. And he said it to me. He says, "Did you hear about Adrian?" And I says, "No, I didn't hear about Adrian. He shot dead," he said. I says, "What?" And I couldn't take it in. I said, what are you saying? I said, "Lordship, there was a robbery and there's shots fired and Adrian was killed." I says, "My good God," he said, "it happened there 5-10 minutes ago." He said, I said, "Oh, geez, I'll be in now straight away, So I just said it to my wife, "Don't expect me now for a day or two. Good luck." And I got in the car and made my way straight to Dundalk. But as I knew exactly the impact this would have, and on my way to Dundalk I rang a number of people that I would need in an investigation of key people that I would need, that I could trust, and they trusted me and I needed them. And when I got into the station, and I refer to it in the book, it was the station of the quivering lip. There was huge emotion, really you were walking through it, and I went to the incident room and it's a big table, and it's the conference table. I went down, there was nobody sitting at it, and they all looked around at me. I sat down and I could see really Joe would have the information that I would require. So I took Joe and one of my detective sergeants to my office and I sat him down and I asked him, I said, "Joe, just tell me in your own words what happened." And we had a good chat, and Joe was relatively calm considering what he had
witnessed.
Oh my good God. And but I went down then to the incident room, and one thing that always struck me was there was guards come in from everywhere. They had heard it on the news, guards from the city from neighbouring counties who...
They sort of presented themselves to help.
That is the essence of what the guards are about and the camaraderie and the morale and all of that. I had to make best use of the manpower in front of me. So what I did is got two of my detective sergeants who were very experienced, and I told them to go to the room next door and draw up a list of 15 or 16 people that are border criminals that may do this or may be involved in it or whatever. And they came back with a list, I don't know, 12 or 13 names.
Just to stop you there for a second, obviously the crime scene has been, closed off. There's forensics there. Yeah. So there's people coming from everywhere to investigate this matter. But the identification of possible suspects, is that happening within hours of that murder?
Yeah. And there was all types of names floating and types of... Anyway.
And was the name Aaron Brady within that mix at that point?
He was, I think, the second or third name down on the list. And I said, I divided in the manpower I had into teams of two. And I gave them each a name. And I said, go and find him. Get him to account for his movements tonight at 9:30. Mm. Where was it and all this, that, and prove it. And John Moroney, who was a sergeant at the time, he's now a superintendent. John says, I know Aaron Brady. I have him before the courts for rammings and that. And he's living in the house in Carlingford. And I sent other teams to take detailed statements from the staff of the credit union, because I needed, let's say, experienced detectives that can sit down and take decent statements, to gather in as much detail as possible.
So I suppose... Fast forward to, you said 2015, you were starting working on this story.
Yeah.
It's 2 years later. Because this investigation has gone on for a long time, and there was, there was complications with it, wasn't there? And it wasn't just the border. It was the individuals concerned. Some of them that were suspect had alibis or gave alibis, and there was difficulties. And I suppose by 2015, where was Aaron Brady and other suspects? Had they gone to the wind?
Yeah, they left fairly soon after him. I think Aaron Brady, in around mid-April 2013, he'd given a statement in the meantime to Gardaí, professing his innocence, lying about his whereabouts that night. Some of the other suspects who have been before the courts, James Flynn, Brandon Traynor, they were also interviewed. And in around April, Aaron Brady left for Newark Airport initially and went to meet James Flynn over there. Now, James Flynn is originally from South Armagh, but he's also an American green card holder. All the families have business over there. So he went over there to lie low for a while, moved up to Boston, where the Flynns have businesses, and was keeping the head down up there for a few months. And then, naturally enough, with these kind of criminals, they had fallen out.
Right.
And Brady's forced then in around early 2014 to move back to New York, and over the next few years kind of starts building this life for himself.
What age is he around then?
He's 20. At the time of the robbery and murder, he was 21.
Right.
So he'd still be around.
So I was going to ask you for a bit of background about him, but he's only 21. Like, I mean, how long is he suspected to have been involved in these...
He would have had a fair bit of form. I think even when he kind of in his mid-teens, he would have grown up between Crossland Glen and Monaghan. The family would have had a property down there. And in around kind of age 16 or 17, he was suspect for a number of burglaries in Monaghan. And really him and that kind of crew he was hanging around with at the time, they became known and prolific for creeper burglaries.
Yeah.
Where you pop the barrel of the door to a house, break in, steal something late at night, normally a car. And they became fairly notorious for it and prolific for it, stealing cars, mainly to be kind of, sold on or broken down for parts. But obviously, the car they stole 3 nights before the Lordship robbery was used for that murder. Mainly for kind of creeper burglaries. And then even during the investigation, it kind of came to light that he's also a suspect for a number of armed robberies to the murder. I think 2011, there was a robbery of a bookmaker and a dog race course where a few thousand euro in sterling was stolen. I think the shotgun used by the gang that was dropped and kind of the intelligence at the time and later on led to Aaron Brady, and like he got the nickname Butterfinger Brady among his associates because he was alleged to have dropped the shotgun and that.
Right.
Yeah. It wasn't,
And had a gun been discharged previous to this robbery? Never.
No.
And was there evidence that he had training? Was he a skilled gunman?
Oh, I'd say he's a pure wally when it comes to guns, And they weren't subversives, they weren't involved in, a cause. They were nothing but pure border criminals who could get away with committing crime because there was
very little policing, not our side, but the other side.
And is there a reason for that? The PSNI won't... No, I mean, you're talking about getting pieces of CCTV in that.
Yeah, there wouldn't.
And even locally in some of those border regions that sort of people are afraid to give up CCTV.
It's very, very simple. Like one particular shop, which we had to obtain CCTV and we had to obtain the top-up records for phones and stuff. And the owner said to us, don't bring the PSNI around here.
This was on the other case now, not on this one.
And we didn't, and they cooperated with us. And we got the CCTV and we got all that we needed. They made statements and they said we'd cooperate with the guards. And they were all summoned to give evidence at the trial, and they all come down and give evidence. Mm-hmm. And Jason O'Driscoll was convicted of both murders. So what I'm saying is that, you know, you can work the far side of the border and get what you need to get. And I proved that in that other case, you know. But this here, these guys, when they know they commit a crime here to get the far side of the border, it's going to happen. That's the way.
That was the confidence they were operating on at that point.
Sure, many times had they drove at police guards and checkpoints and driven through and that type of thing. They knew if they were chased at the border, guards would have to stop.
Yeah. You know. And, you know, there was a few kind of narrow roads really, weren't there? But they knew them inside out all the rest of it. They were travelling them all the time. So Aaron Brady is, and other suspects are in the States 2014 into 2015.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, the investigation, presumably there wasn't enough to arrest him or to charge him before he went. In the meantime, however, sort of around the you know, as Aaron Brady and others realise that they are clear suspects, they have gone to the States. So there isn't at that point enough evidence to charge them. So the investigation team has to kind of look on as they flee the jurisdiction, as they flee the country.
No, when I came back in and I took charge of the investigation again, I think it was 2015 or 16 or whatever, I couldn't understand how Aaron Brady was not arrested and brought back for the domestic warrants that were in existence at that time. And I made the point, I says, how can we justify knowing that this man is in America and there's domestic warrants here for him? Like, we can't be seen to be pandering. You know, the law has to be upheld and that's it. And that's what I put in place was for him to be brought back. And the guards that were dealing with that particular incident of him ramming and that and those warrants, that they were to look after that. But in the meantime, we actually got a break. We had a Sinn Féin councillor in out in Carlingford had done a report and put it in the local paper and put it on his Facebook account about the terrible murder that was, and if anyone has information, they should make themselves known. And a friend of his who was living in America, New York, contacted him and says, I know something about that fella, that fella Aaron Brady. He says, get the guards to contact me.
Mm.
So I know the job. I says, I'll deal with this job because I could see there's potential in this. And I rang this guy, Christy Martin, in America, and I got talking to him. And he was telling me, he said it to me, he says, I met Aaron Brady in a pub one night, it was after a wedding, and he told me that he shot the guard.
Mm.
And I was, you know, I says, Grant, I said, will you put that down in a statement? And he says, no, he wouldn't. And I'm just telling you, I'm trying to help you out, like he said. And I said, that's fine. I said, but I do need to have it on, you know, in writing. So I spoke with him for a period of 3 months, on and off, chatting and talking, and I was trying to tell him, like, you know, to do the right thing, and it's no good having this knowledge and not departing it in a way that's going to benefit the investigation and bring Aaron Brady to justice.
So you're coming up into about 2016 at this point, is it? 2016?
She made the statement saying that Aaron Brady said he shot the guard. And,
okay.
And she said it in front of other people that were there.
But I suppose in the meantime, between 2013 and this point when you're starting to get witnesses come forward, now the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, from my memory, were involved in this investigation.
Mm.
Is that right? They come into it at some point. There was two.
I think on secondment there full time as well.
Yeah.
Mark Phillips and Jim McGovern were dedicated officers to this investigation here. So there's obviously a lot, and it will have ultimately come up in the trial. But on the ground here, there was a lot of kind of profiling of other robberies to try and conjoin what evidence might connect them. Presumably there was a huge amount of CCTV captured and, you know, alibi checking and everything. So what sort of stuff, like the level of the investigation, did that come out in the trial?
Came out in the work. Like, I think CCTV, there's about over 40,000 hours that had to be reviewed, 320 odd locations. I think about three sergeants and 30 guard had to go through it all bit by bit. And in the trial later on, that would be critical, especially in terms of the theft of the getaway car used in the murder, to kind of pinpoint that to Aaron Brady and to Jimmy Flynn, who was later convicted of conspiracy to steal that car.
What happened to that car? Was it burnt out?
The evidence was that James Flynn's BMW, three nights before the murder, himself, Aaron Brady, and a third man drove that in the early hours from their house near Lord Credit Union down south, or I suppose south of Ireland, to Claughterhead. They were on CCTV driving around, creeping around for a bit, looking for a car to steal. They then stole the car in the early hours of the morning from Hillcrest, a black Volkswagen Passat. And then there's further footage of them driving back north towards Dunroman House, arriving back there around 10 to 5. And kind of the circumstantial evidence the prosecution would later point to was that this is all part of this conspiracy to steal the car that was eventually used in Adrian Dunhu's murder.
Mm. So the theft of the car became very critical to prove the people that were there and the murder, essentially.
Yeah, it was all part of this kind of circumstantial case, you know. It was a massive part.
Because those circumstantial cases are enormous. Like, I mean, they just take so much work, you know.
6,000 lines of inquiry.
Yeah. Well, what does that mean, like a line of inquiry? It's
the average murder, if you can call it a murder average, but will generate around 250 lines of inquiry, roughly. And Adrian's...
And a line of inquiry could be to gather the CCTV, or it could be to
preservation of the scene,
to call to a house maybe that has a camera on it, whatever.
Yeah. And this was 6,000 lines of inquiry.
Now, and is that because
managing that?
The inquiry also went backwards into these previous robberies? So each one of those robberies had to be investigated.
All of those have to be investigated.
No. So that was all kind of going on and being collated into this case and been brought together into the file.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, it was important to try and get some admission from the likes of Aaron Brady, and that admission would be from witnesses who he spoke to. He was drunk in pubs, basically, is what came out.
Yeah, most of it was. Yeah.
The border criminal and the border monkey, as I call them, like these people, don't cooperate. It's, you know, there's only one thing worse than a paedophile, as they say, is a tout. And they lived by that. That was
that omerta, that code, it sits so strongly up around there. What's he doing in the States? He's working and he's getting drunk.
He's making good money. I think he ended up earning about $65 an hour driving heavy machinery. He met a woman from Kerry over there. He ended up having a child. He was doing well for himself. And
this is all around pre-2016?
I think 2017 he was arrested for domestic warrants.
Right.
For overstaying his welcome there, brought back in domestic charges. So between kind of 2014 and 2017, and by all intents and purposes, he seemed to live the life over there. You know, he'd go to football games, baseball games on dates. He'd spend his wages in the pubs along Catona Avenue in Woodlawn, it's kind of real Irish community, and he just couldn't help himself. I think seven people came forward and ended up giving statements to give evidence, but I think it was an open secret over in Woodlawn that Aaron Brady...
He would go out and he would, you know, if he got drunk enough, he would to tell everybody how serious he was. He would boast about this. So explain, when you said there that he was brought back on domestic warrants in 2017, what happened then?
So I think it's May 2017. He's arrested by Homeland Security and a few different agencies. He obviously flew over there on a three-month visa in 2013, was meant to go home earlier than he did. He was deported, essentially, back to Ireland. There's domestic warrants here for a dangerous driving incident in Dock.
Ramming of taxi driving cars.
I think it was a couple of years before the murder at Lordship. He caused housing or damage.
So that means he's charged before the courts. He's been called and he's absent. So the judge will issue a bench warrant for his arrest.
Well, he had actually, it's funny enough, he pleaded guilty to the offences of dangerous driving and ramming and all that before he left. So
it was during a sentencing he didn't appear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all that needed to be decided on then.
Okay.
On those warrants, like, you know, was
to, and a bench warrant is issued. I mean, bench warrants are issued quite a lot in the country when people don't show up either during a trial or, you know, after it for sentencing. Mm-hmm. But how active would Gardaí be when there's a bench warrant if somebody's out of the country? Do they largely wait till they come back to the country, or do they actively go after somebody? Does it matter, sort of, this bigger picture with him where he was a suspect?
Well, I can't answer for what was happening in the time. I wasn't in charge of the investigation, but what I'm saying is that if you look at any warrant, is to bring the person without delay to before the courts. And I'm saying that the fact that he wasn't being brought back straight away or within a reasonable time, would it invalidate the warrant or give him an argument in respect of the lackluster approach the guards were taking in respect of these ones?
And when but the Gardaí would still have to, they would still have to apply, presumably, for the finances to go and get somebody.
No. What you do, basically, is you turn the domestic warrant into a European arrest or into an international arrest warrant, like, you know. So that's what you're doing. Or in his case, because he might have went to England or wherever, like at some other stage, we could get a European arrest warrant. But the warrant has turned into a warrant that could be used to be executed in a foreign jurisdiction.
Okay.
But in this case, Aaron Brady was brought back because he was an illegal immigrant.
But somebody had to do that sort of political conversations, I presume, with Homeland Security to sort of, I mean, somebody had to kind of push Homeland Security. I'm sure there's a load of people in the States, but there's warrants for their arrest and they carry on regardless.
We had an interest in Aaron Brady, absolutely. And I couldn't understand why he was over there. And, you know, when there was warrants here for him. And it was actually John Maroney who was the member in charge of dealing with that particular case. And the I'd say the pressure was put on, but like Aaron Brady was going to be brought back. That was it. And John Maroney and those looked after him coming back, and Homeland Security, which is deals with that end of things.
Who's John Maroney?
He was the sergeant who had Aaron Brady charged with all the
domestic
issues.
Okay.
And he was the man who went out that night to see could he find him, to ask him to come for his movements, and he wasn't there.
Right.
So he was a person on that list that now became a person of interest. Why? Because he couldn't be found, he was there. Mm. And John Maroney stopped them the next day by fluke on the road, not too far from the bridge, and spoke to him and Jimmy Flynn. And he was cute enough to take one away and talk to the other, and they had given different stories. And Aaron Brady even given the wrong phone number.
So that it forms part then of this file, this case against him.
I thought it was a huge break. And I said it to John Maroney, I said, this is fantastic police work, I said, now, because I can work on this now. And then I looked at the phone numbers, like the phone calls they made after they had been stopped. Mm. And of course, Aaron Brady was ringing his girlfriend, you know, and she eventually told us he was ringing me to tell me, back me up. I was there earlier.
For an alibi, yeah.
For an alibi. That was grand. And then one of the phone numbers that both of them rang was Benny Traynor. Mm-hmm. And Benny Traynor was the suspect in the first armed robbery and arrested and questioned by Adrian Donoghue in respect of it. So I'm saying this is too much of a coincidence. Like,
yeah,
there's something here and we have to develop this.
And this forms part of the file. So 2017, he's brought back and he is in prison for this.
Yeah, he's initially sentenced to, I think, a year or 6 months in total.
Yeah.
And then that's appealed by the DPP for undue leniency. And a few months later, it's increased to a year in total. So,
okay. And all the while, the investigation is going on in the background to piece together. We have now at this stage, you have the alibis. Perhaps you have
CCTV. We had
different statements being given by them. You have the CCTV. You have his fleeing to the US, and you have witnesses in the US who have said they will give evidence that he sort of loud-mouthed that he had done this. Yeah. So the case is coming together.
It is.
I think people find it difficult to understand how long it takes for these cases to come together.
And
what was the delay?
just the amount of, I suppose, at the scene itself, there was no, and I think this was a comment made by the Special Criminal Court in a recent case about it, there's no forensic evidence at the scene. You know, within 58 seconds, they were there and gone. So there's no DNA, no forensics to put them at the scene. And there's no confession evidence either. None of them ever admitted to Gardaí or in interviews that they did it. So it's very hard to place them at the scene unless you have a significant circumstantial case. And you talk about CCTV. A massive part of it as well was phone evidence. When kind of they, Pat and his team looked at the phones that night.
Yeah, we looked at 65 phones in total over the course of the investigation. When you mean looking at phones, you're looking at that initial phone and what that tells you. And then you might have to go into another phone and what that might tell you. And all the time you're making an application, crime and security, for this information, and then they have to relay that on to the service providers. But we have to be always sure that the application is necessary, proportioned, you know, and that's what we had to do. And we had to prove that in a document for each phone record. And
but in terms of the evidence, suppose you got from that, if you looked at Jimmy Flynn's phone, Aaron Brady's phone, Brendan Traynor, and another man, I suppose Mr. C, we've called him in the book because he can't be named for legal reasons, but he is a suspect in the murder and robbery. All of their phones went off in around an hour before the murder, within about 20 minutes of one another.
They just switched them off.
They weren't active, well, silent. There's no activity in or out.
What we did as well, in respect to that, we went back, I went back for the previous two Fridays to see, were these phones active? And they were. They were working normally.
So you're trying to prove that this was unusual, that they they don't speak to one another at this particular time on this particular day.
And that the raiders were using walkie-talkies, because the witnesses in the car park, they see one of them with a walkie-talkie, and they described it with the aerial and the green screen, and so that's how they were communicating. Yeah. So there's no need for phones, and they were sort of phone savvy at the time. But I remember at the time I said it, in the investigation, I said, this is great. I said, because this is evidence. I'm going to use this as evidence, the fact they had the phones were inactive. They're the people that the fingers are pointing at. So, you know.
So when is he eventually charged?
He's arrested walking out the gates of Weefield Prison, Cloverhill Prison in Dublin in late February 2018. He's taken into custody, and then think the full 7 days where he was the question on.
Was, yeah.
He didn't say much and during interrogation there. He kind of said, so no comment was the main approach he took. Sorry, Fatou.
Yeah, and you talk about NBCI, National Bureau of Criminal Investigations, pure gentlemen, absolutely brilliant detectives. And they looked after the interviewing of Aaron Brady, but like it was something like.
Well, they're skilled. Skilled at that. And of course, you have to put everything to a suspect that if they're going to use it at trial. So actually that is such an important part of a circumstantial case, isn't it?
Part of
it gives them a chance to kind of respond to it.
And if they don't, answer a question, that can be sort of, there can be inference.
The inference of the interview, like, you know.
So you had retired at this point?
No, I hadn't retired. No. I was still there right up. I charged him with the murder. NBCI were absolutely excellent, and Mark Phillips and Jim McGovern put the document together to brief everyone in respect of the interviewing. And we had our level fours, level threes. We had a very good team of detectives ready to interview. And it's a skill in itself, interviewing, and the strategy around interviewing is very important as well, that you don't go in and blurt everything out in the first go, because you need to bring it along step by step. But they were excellent, very, very good.
So he is interviewed over 7 days, and is at that point after that the file is sent to the DPP?
No. I was in contact with the DPP all along when he was finished being interviewed. It's only then you can get a direction from the DPP. You can't get a direction from the DPP when someone is still being in they're still being detained under it's only when you're finished questioning them in full that you can get that direction. And I got that direction.
So he was charged after the 7 day when he was arrested. So he was charged. So he's before the courts. Yeah. So the first trial starts
January 2020, just before the COVID pandemic.
And what happened with that?
It went on for, it hadn't been the longest trial in criminal history. It went on till August, 121 days. It sat for, heard from over 150 witnesses. And I suppose despite the best efforts of Aaron Braden's associates to intimidate witnesses and prevent people from coming forward. A jury found him guilty by a majority verdict of capital murder, and they also found him, he was obviously charged with a second offence of robbery of the €7,000 in cash during the raid, and they found him guilty unanimously that he was one of the raiders.
Mm-hmm. And what date was that?
12th of August 2020. When the jury
but it doesn't feel like it was that far away, far back.
Yeah, I suppose during the COVID pandemic, I think it was the only trial happening in the CCJ for months.
Yeah.
It was essentially like a ghost town going in and out, you know.
So the jury had to come down and sit where the normal, the public would sit.
Yeah. Wasn't there two courtrooms?
Yeah, they opened up the next courtroom for people to go in and view it.
Yes, there has been a lot of activity and campaigning from people on Aaron Brady's side who say this was an incorrect judgment, he's appealing, and that there was the evidence wasn't there. Isn't that what they're saying on social media? They're out there saying that there was...
That's the tenet of the argument, yeah. But you know, during that trial, Aaron Brady had two senior counsels, Mike O'Higgins and Fiona Murphy. And Mike O'Higgins is one of, if not the most respected senior counsel in defence barrister in the country. And he had a proper defence. He had a very good defence. And over 8 months in a court of law, the evidence given by the prosecution was strenuously tested. In a lot of cases, the evidence they wanted to deduce was thrown out or ruled inadmissible for various reasons. So he had a fantastic defence, and now he has an appeal on various grounds before the courts. And you know, a jury of his peers found him guilty by majority verdict. Any issues with that are going to the Court of Appeal now. They're reserving their judgment. It's not out yet, but you know, he has fantastic lawyers working on his behalf to, I suppose, find him not guilty or have a retrial ordered through the court of law. And that's the only question.
Which is his entitlement, I suppose. So what was this? Tell me about the trial and what were the standout moments of it?
I think massive standout part of it was because obviously the COVID pandemic, the witnesses who were over in America wanted to come over but couldn't give evidence, so they had to give testimonial via video link, which was approved and accepted by the judge. And one of the key witnesses, Molly Staunton, who was a girlfriend of Aaron Brady's former roommate in the US, she'd given a statement that she heard Aaron Brady admit on several occasions that he admitted to shooting a cop, was the word she used. And while she was giving evidence from her living room, I think it was in New York, it was interrupted by a third party. Now, this person had no connection to Aaron Brady, from what we know. But there was an initial intervention without the jury present, and there was a bit of, I think there's some kind of background issues there anyway between them, and he was a bit abusive towards her. The next day then, back in front of the jury as she's about to give or continue to give evidence, there's another argument between them, and this third party kind of shouts into the laptop, "No more evidence, you can put a stop to it," and slams her laptop down. And
it's so bizarre.
Crazy. Like, you know, I don't know how to react to it. Like, you know, I think everyone in the court was kind of stunned about what we do here. And obviously, is Molly Staunton all right as well, you know? And if that, like, you know, imagine that happening in the court itself, you know, it is a person giving live evidence. So I haven't seen the likes of that in the court before, and hopefully we won't again.
And you mentioned there, you know, initially when that happened, this man wasn't known to Aaron Brady, but there was some witness intimidation.
There was, the second or probably the most standout part that didn't happen from the jury was, I think it was May 7th, Brendan Grehan, the senior counsel prosecuting the place, stood up and asked for the court to be cleared, basically, of everyone, apart from members of the press who are entitled to be there, and prosecuting Gardaí in that. And it became apparent that a video had been circulating of Ronan Flynn, who was another key witness or potential key witness, who gave a statement that Aaron Brady admitted the murder to him, that his witness statement, which was video recorded in the United States, had been leaked online and was circulating initially among the border community and further afield, I don't think, but as far as the US and Australia. And I think it was four different excerpts of him talking to Gardaí and calling him a tout, saying he was touting on his cousins, that he, you know, given statements in return for green cards and all these sort of unfounded allegations. And that was just weeks or days or weeks anyway before he was due to give evidence in that trial. And that was a serious attempt to pervert the course of justice. I think Justice Michael White said at the time that it's clear the court can't do anything about this. It can't stop the dissemination. It can't really warn the jury without alerting to the fact. And it was the most outrageous contempt of court he'd ever seen in 20 years as a judge.
And what was discovered about that?
So I think it became fairly evident fairly quickly that Aaron Brady was responsible for that video being recorded in the first instance. The NBCI, a different unit from the team on the investigation, raided a cell. Prisoners, some are entitled to laptops to view cases, like evidence against them in cases coming up. I think Aaron Brady is one of them. I think Alan Wilson was another one. I think due to one of the trials he's involved in, there's a large amount of electronic evidence and he's obviously entitled to view it, so he's given a laptop. But it became fairly clear that Aaron Brady had taken this laptop. He'd somehow gotten in a recording device, a mobile phone presumably, and taken a number of videos.
Sort of screen grabbed a video from the laptop that he was supposed to be just looking at the evidence that was coming against him.
Took a video of it. I think he made a comment, effing pig's head as well, and one of them when Flynn's kind of given the statement against him saying he admitted to it. That was taken, I think the video itself was taken in around April, and then lo and behold, just under three weeks later, it started circulating, and it was fairly obvious that, you know, Aaron Brady had sent this onwards. Now, there was nothing to suggest that he...
When you say it was fairly obvious, so and he would subsequently be charged in relation to that?
He was charged, and he since pleaded guilty as well to recording the video statement.
Like, can you hear his voice on that? Would you hear his voice?
You can't. He only says one thing, I think, that effing pig's head comment.
And what did he think he was going to... Did he think he was going to get away with that? Or I think that's a sort of an individual who really sort of has a belief that they can get away with anything, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was obviously intended to not just intimidate Ronan Flynn, who gave the statement, but other witnesses. And now there were seven who had evidence to give, only two gave evidence. So it clearly worked to a certain extent as well.
Mm.
Ronan Flynn obviously didn't end up giving evidence in the trial itself.
Long time for the jury to sit and listen to that evidence. I mean, 121 days. So that... Yeah. Goes over what? About 10?
I think it was about 8.
Say 10?
I think 8 months, but 2 months in between with COVID and legal argument. Mm. Didn't see it anyway. So.
And then there was, before the trial, there was a month of disclosure arguments.
Yeah.
So we were in court for 6 months easy.
Yeah, before it. So he is currently serving a life sentence. He pleaded guilty to that witness intimidation.
Yeah.
And got... Well, he hasn't been sentenced on that.
Yet, no. So he
one way or another, that would just sit as regards, that would maybe affect his parole if it comes to that, as opposed to...
Yeah, but I don't see him...
Can you add on to a life sentence?
I think a life sentence with minimum 40 years, I don't see it being added.
No.
You could, in theory, but I don't see it happening. But it's the first time in a court of law he's admitted his guilt to anything, so it was surprising.
And why that life sentence? I mean, that's one of the biggest sentences that's been handed down. Was it capital murder? Was it?
Yeah, it was capital murder,
yeah. And how often has there been a conviction for capital murder in this country?
We only had one there recently enough. I think during that trial, during Aaron Brady's trial, Colm Horkin was on patrol in Cassaree and he was shot dead by Stephen Silver. And I think there was two trials in that.
There was, yeah.
And going here, but the second trial...
I covered a bit of that, actually.
Yeah, Stephen.
So that was going on at the same time, was it? Maybe that's the trial I was thinking of.
That could be the case, I think.
Yeah.
Prior to that, capital murder, I think 1985, before Aaron Brady's conviction. 1985 was the last conviction for capital murder.
What age is Aaron Brady now?
He's 33 now.
Mm. Yeah. So if he does serve out that term, he'll be in his 70s?
There's questions over that as well, if you're entitled to standard remission as well.
Yeah.
Any prisoner is entitled to 25%. I think there is precedent where if you are serving 40 years, or minimum 40 years, you're entitled to that 25% as well. So
okay,
that could be challenged now, but I think the precedent is there that you may only serve 30 years.
Well, I'll put it this way, 30 years and he has a child, like he's going to miss out his whole life.
Mm.
Relationship with his child.
Big stakes on the appeal though, and I mean, you can, you know, it would have been surprising had this not been appealed in the light of, I mean, any murder conviction really,
it's appealed,
people will appeal.
Yeah, 99 times out of 100.
Yeah.
Especially the sentence.
We weren't surprised, like, you know.
Did you get a sense of what sort of a guy he was from the trial? You know, sometimes you can get a little bit of a sense of whether somebody's a bit arrogant or...
Yeah, well, sure. He gave evidence in the trial, which again, itself, murder accused, is rare. But sure.
He was the victim in all of this.
Yeah. And what did he come across as when he was giving the evidence?
Cocky, just full of his own self-importance and believed what he's telling, the lies he told. You would have obviously been in at the Monk's trial, Brendan Graham, defended the Monk and cross-examined Jonathan Dowdall. And that was intense, to say the least. And it was similar when he was cross-examined Aaron Brady. Yeah, He tore him to shreds basically in front of the jury.
Over a number of days.
Over 5 days, I think it was. Yeah, he had him in the box. And
Brendan Graham. Like.
Did that change him then? The cross-examination, you know what I mean? Like, people get up to give evidence, and when they're being questioned by their own side, it's kind of on their terms. They're answering gentle questions, really, and they're giving their side. But under cross-examination, that's really, I think, when people are tested.
Well, you know,
did that change his personality?
It wore him down. If you compare him to the first day, to the fifth day, I think, he was kind of done by the fifth day of being pummeled for...
But Brendan Graham had sort of turned around on him and said, look, you're the victim in all... Yeah, I'm the victim in all of this. Like, you know, he was making himself out that I'm the one that's being harassed.
And I mean, it would be his case that... What, that the Gardaí harassed him and followed him to the States and dragged him home and...
Yeah, and all of that stuff,
Yeah, that he had nothing to do with it at all, that... Mm. I think in relation to the theft of the getaway car, he said he couldn't remember what was happening that day.
Right.
Brendan Graham himself remarked it was strange that it's one of the most important days of his life.
Yeah.
In the context of being on trial, he just couldn't remember. And then I think he said during the time of the murder and robbery, eventually he said in the lead to the trial that he changed his story again and said he was laundering diesel in a diesel yard in Concession Road, despite no evidence put in there, no statements, no witnesses.
And then he said, before the trial started, he came up with a new alibi to say that he had been in doing the diesel laundering. But before that, he had a witness that had said, look, he was with me at the time on Lock Road.
Mm-hmm.
But that alibi was broken. So now he, just before the trial started, he comes up and says, oh, he was in a shed and diesel laundering and that,
I think the second prosecuting senior counsel, Lorcan Staines, put it well in his closing speech to the jury. He said Aaron Brady had, you know, 2 years of disclosure to look through and kind of carefully mould his case and mould his alibi and suit his narrative. Changed so many times, like, you know, that he was able to craft this alibi, which he think would work, which ultimately didn't work.
Is the investigation ongoing?
Yeah, there's still hope. I suppose it'll never end the way, but there are still hopes that the third person who was with Aaron Brady and Jimmy Flynn that night stealing the car, they'll face prosecution. I think that person's living in the United States at the moment.
He is presently in Boston,
And I think in relation to the others who were actually in the car park itself, unless somebody comes forward.
So we know who they are. We have the names, but it's if you don't have evidence, that's it in the story.
And what other convictions are there in relation to the death of Detective Donoghue?
Well, Aaron Brady is the only person who has been convicted of the murder, capital murder. And I think the prosecution case in his trial was that it wasn't joint enterprise common design. So even the people if found to be in the car park with him couldn't be convicted of murder. Mm. Two others who Gardaí and the state alleged were in the car park were put in trial in 2023, Jimmy Flynn and Brendan Traynor. They were acquitted of robbery, but James Flynn was found to have conspired to steal the getaway car used in the murder. So there's two convictions in relation to the arrest so far.
Yeah.
He received an 8-year sentence, I think, for that. Jimmy Flynn.
Yeah. And of course, at the end of it, none of it brings him back, which is so tragic for his family and his wife. I think Caroline was a detective herself. Was she a member of the Guards? And she has since...
She was a member of the Guards in Dundalk. She wasn't a detective now. She was, a family liaison or that type of stuff. But... She couldn't, like, you couldn't expect the lady to come to work under any circumstances like that. So she retired.
And his kids, I'm sure, are grown up now, considering how long ago it's what.
Yeah, but you look at this, it's a story that has to be told in respect of how Aaron Brady was brought to justice and what the Guards had to do and the ins and outs of the night and over the next 5 years to bring him to justice. You know, it shows that the Guards can do the job. There are professional people who can get to the truth, and that they, even though it was a circumstantial case, that the circumstances were represented in a very professional manner. So,
and I suppose it was the amount of people involved in actually that, you know, that successful conviction.
It's a team effort.
It's a team effort.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, you know, when you take the CCTV alone, there had to be a whole team put on that and a sergeant in charge of it. The same with phones. And like even dealing with Aaron Brady, we had the two NBCI detectives who took a marvellous statement over a 2-day period. Like, you know, and that statement that he made was hugely evidential to us in showing that he was lying and that, you know, that what he was telling the Guards was wrong. Like,
And, you know, I suppose that in the middle of it, wasn't there, there was all sorts of other murders going on. Like a murder inquiry must suck up a huge amount of resources in an area.
Absolutely.
And during it as well, we had, I suppose, the beginnings of that Drogheda feud, which was same region, mm-hmm. and sucking up a lot of the resources yeah. while, you know, you still needed to yeah. keep the commitment on this.
And there were still legacy cases. There was still, like, you know, Ciara Breen. There was the Michael Shine, Our Lady of Lourdes investigation that went on for years. I had Irene White.
Tony Golden.
So, like, what I'm saying is that it's Dundalk was a bedrock of commotion in respect of serious crime. And you had to keep your head and you had to treat each one of them seriously and move them along you had a formula and you applied that, and that's what got you through a lot of it. You know?
And it must have been a huge amount to his family that the commitment was there over so many years by so many people who worked with him and knew him and loved him, that, you know, to come to get a bit of closure for them.
And it was always said at the conference table, and I've said it many a time, you know, or 6 months in or 8 months in or a year in or whatever we're with about, and keep in mind, if one of us was killed, Adrian Donoghue would be the very man sitting there doing his utmost to get.
Yeah.
So we will never lose sight of that. It kept people motivated.
For sure, and the camaraderie that exists.
And it was, yeah. Adrian was a lovely guy. Lovely guy, you know.
Robin, your first book?
First one.
First of many?
We'll see how this one goes. Uh-huh. So when the sales come out.
It's a long process, isn't it?
Yeah, tough slog, but it's passing there. You know, it's a story that has to be told, and to, I suppose, show the amount of work that went in across the organisation. Yeah. You know, Adrian's colleague, to Lou as a colleague in those circumstances is tough, but serious. To try professionally investigate then and, you know, get a conviction as a result is, it's just a testament to the Gardaí that are up there. So between the Gardaí and the Dock, the MBCI, the prosecution team, the agents in Homeland Security.
A lot of good people along the way, a lot of good people.
Pretty shows the amount of work that went into that.
And it was well worth the work that went into writing it. I think I met you in the newsroom a few times when you were kind of at your wit's end. You just never think a book is going to finish. Like, you start it and think, oh, I know all this. And then it's like getting it out from there to there.
It's just the agent, that's tough going.
Remember harder than we think.
Last summer I was in Greece for 2 weeks. And it was horrendously hot, and it was in Athens, and I was staying with a friend. She has a big apartment, a lovely balcony and air conditioning and all that type of stuff, and they used to go out and sit under the shade and I'd write and just sit there and have a beer and be writing away.
It's quite a nice place to write now, in fairness, you know.
So it was
a bit nicer in Talbot Street.
I don't think Robin had that luxury.
No, he was
here in Talbot Street. Well, listen, Pat Murray and Robin Schiller, thank you very much. Murder at Lordship, Inside the Hunt for a Detective's Killer, is out this week. Thank you.
Exactly.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Claude Amini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.